House Committee on Judiciary Subcommittee on Family Justice, Wednesday, February 20, 1991, 3 p.m., hearing room 357, public hearing and possible work session.
Family and Juvenile Justice. I keep trying to rename the committee and nobody will...
Rename the committee?
Nobody will pick it up. We'll come to order. We have two bills today that we're going to have public hearing on. I frankly don't know whether we'll move into work session or not. And one bill that we'll have the work session. It's the chair's intent to have us done by 4:45. And we are missing Representative Mannix and Representative Bauman. So Professor Mason has brought us our history lesson for today. For those of you in the audience who don't know, we try to start as many of our sessions as possible with just a little bit of Oregon history, based on the notion that we would make fewer mistakes if we knew more about history. So far, it hasn't worked, but so, Professor.
Well, further explanation, and for this to make sense, we had a bill yesterday involving, and it's not, it's only humorous in historical context, involving animals. And this is not Oregon history, this goes even farther back, but reading from Lawrence Friedman's History of American Law, he says, in Massachusetts, the death penalty was imposed on those who particularly outraged the morals of society. In 1673, Benjamin Goad, quote, being instigated by the devil, committed the unnatural and horrid act of bestiality on a mare, the highway. This was on the afternoon, the sun being 2 hours high. The court of assistants sentenced him to hang, and the court also ordered that, quote, the mare you abused before your execution in your sight shall be knocked in the head. So they had the double death penalty.
Thank you.
Back to Oregon next time.
House Bill 2492. We have some testimony we need to hear on House Bill 2492. We will ask Jerry Fitzgerald from the Department of Justice to come up. And while she's coming up, sorry. She's about to sign out. Right. Mr. Chair, why don't you hold on for just a second? Do we have it? I have Jerry Fitzgerald and Dean Renfro signed up to testify on House Bill 2492. Is there anyone else signed up to testify? Okay, would you come forward, please? Great, it's nice to have you back. Tell us your name again, please, for the record.
My name is Bobby Shelton, and I'm here to support House Bill 2492.
All right. Ms. Shelton was before us before, if you remember, and we ran out of time. We wanted to get her whole story, so we asked her to come back, and which she's done, and we're glad you did that. So please go ahead and give us your testimony.
I feel there should be more help for the victim and the families than there is for the offender. On September 15, 1989, I was a victim of sodomy in the first degree, attempted rape in the first degree, and assault four by a convicted rapist in my own home. When the police and detectives came to my home to question me, everything seemed in a haze, almost slow motion. Everyone wanting answers and all those unfamiliar faces, except one, and that was a nice policeman putting his hand out to me, telling me I could trust him, and I did. Shortly after, my daughter arrived home from school, confused and crying, she asked me what happened. I was unable to answer her. The policeman took her into the kitchen to calm her down and told her to go to the neighbors. She left, later returning, saying the neighbor told her what had happened. The police told her she could stay with her mom, but they needed to question her some more. Amanda looked at me and began to cry, telling me she was sorry. The next day, the detective came, returned, telling me they had Mr. Cowan in custody because he basically admitted to the crime. He said when they arrested Mr. Cowan at his home, Mr. Cowan looked at his wife and said, I'm going to prison. Later in questioning, the detective asked him if he had a gun at Bobby Shelton's home. He said, no, but I wished I would have. The detective told me I was eligible for victim's comp for any lost wages or injuries and counseling. I filled all the necessary papers and forms and waited to hear from them. Because of the memories and the threat to myself and my family, we decided to move. My daughter had to be watched going to and from school by a detective. When I told my daughter, she cried and told me she didn't want to be to move, that she would be good, but she wasn't telling me what she meant. Shortly after, I talked with her school counselor, and she told me Amanda was blaming herself for the attack, that she would need more intense counseling than he could give her. I told him I was waiting for victims comp, and soon she would have the counseling needed. Later that day, when Amanda came home from school, I explained to her there was nothing she could have done to stop the attack. She said, "Mom, I'm just a kid. He wouldn't have hurt me." I told her he had been in prison in the past for raping a woman by gunpoint with her 2-year-old daughter screaming for her mommy in the next room. Later, I felt maybe I shouldn't have told her that, but I was confused. I didn't know what to say. After we borrowed the money to move, Amanda seemed to be adjusting to her new school and home, so I thought. I was in training for a state job, trying only to concentrate on my tests and going on with my life. My husband, too, continued to work, trying to put memories in the past. We all tried to be strong, but after a while, becoming exhausted through the defense attorney's cruel attacks, the motions for my past to be brought up into trial, the motions for Cowan's release didn't seem to end. I finally resigned from my job. I wondered how the state could even consider Cowan's release, thinking to myself maybe I should have never reported the attack, or maybe it was my fault. My daughter came out of her room and asked me why I was crying. I said I was just tired. She said she prayed to God for her mom, but he didn't hear her. Then she said, "I'm only 11 years old, and there is a lot I don't understand, but what I do understand is I never reported rape. I'd rather be a rapist, and maybe then I'd be protected too. Well, maybe not a rapist, but a murderer." The past few months, I have found pictures in her room of Cowan's privates being shredded and telling him in a letter she should have killed him for hurting her mom. During the trial, my husband took a lot of time off work to be with me. Between me resigning from my job and him not working, we went in debt. My husband went back to Victims Comp and asked them to help us. They said they were unable to help us because of being understaffed and underfunded. Then he went to welfare. They too denied us. So again, he went back to Victims Comp. Finally, they helped. Not enough, but some. They said I would have to be in counseling, but under the current law, my daughter and husband could not get the counseling from Victims Comp. I started into counseling, but it didn't seem to be helping. When I would come home, my husband and daughter would look at me wanting answers themselves, how to get through this attack themselves and how they could help me. I started making excuses why I couldn't make it to my counselor's appointment. I had been in shock since the attack and I was exhausted and confused. I resented our justice system even more for not helping my family, leaving it up to me when I couldn't even help myself. Later, I became suicidal. I just wanted to sleep. I started back to work knowing I wasn't ready, but I had no choice. I gave my daughter my work number and told her to call me, but only in an emergency. She started calling me every day for no reason, so I thought. I finally called her school counselor, asking her what was going on. She said, earlier that day, the principal and herself had to pick Amanda up off the bathroom floor because Amanda insisted she wasn't going back to class. She wanted her mom. Amanda later told her counselor she was afraid for her mom because she felt like her mom was going to trial and hadn't won yet. The counselor told me Amanda is now coming out with her fears of the attack, and she was begging me to get her into counseling, and that Amanda needs intensive counseling at least twice a week. Later, I talked to my daughter. She said, "Mom, you've changed since what happened." I asked her what she meant. She said, "You seem angry or worried, maybe sad like me." I told her, I guess in a lot of ways, I am angry, but not at her. I told her the offender is in the prison where he belongs, but I don't feel he is being punished enough. He is being fed better than I can feed you. He can go to school and get an education paid by the state. He gets the counseling he needs paid by the state, in which I don't understand because there is no hope for him to change. He's proved that. We went in debt because of the attack. I should have been compensated more than I was. I should be compensated now. My daughter said, "This is our justice system, Mom," and I said, "Yes, this is our system." For the next couple days, I went back into that world. I tried to forget, but how can I when it was happening again? If Amanda would have had the counseling she needed then, maybe she would be okay now. I decided to fight for what I believe in. Fighting has become a way of life, for myself anyway. When I went back to work, they fired me. I understood it was my own fault. I applied for welfare grant. I applied for welfare, and my grant is only $380 a month, not even enough to cover my rent. We teach our children that if someone touches you in places you're not comfortable, you tell someone. I ask you this, should we be telling our children the hard, cold facts of what a victim goes through and what our so-called justice system allows for the victim and the family to go through? Are we lying to our children, or to our children, are we lying to ourselves? We learn to beg because we have no choice. We learn to fight in order to survive. We learn to be murderers within our own hearts. We learn to hate, a learned hate, through the perpetrator in our system. I'm asking your help in passing this bill to help victims and their families, especially the children. Haven't we lied to them enough?
Thank you very much, Ms. Shelton. We appreciate you coming back. We appreciate your story. And as we've said to some other folks who've come in front of us, it takes tremendous courage for you to come tell us a story. We hear a lot about the laws and the technicalities and the way all this works, but we need to hear the real stories, so we appreciate you coming back. Representative Courtney, did you have...
No, I just want to thank you for being allowing us to come back and present the case in detail that she didn't get a chance to do so last
right.
time. I really appreciate that.
And we do apologize that we weren't able to hear your testimony last time around. We didn't want to rush it, and we wanted to hear the whole story. So, any questions for Ms. Shelton or for Representative Courtney? All right, thank you very much. With the committee's indulgence, we will take a 3-minute recess, and we'll be back at 3:25. I certainly don't understand very much about the Crime Victims Fund, Compensation Fund. I'd like to know a little bit more about it, how it's funded, what sources contribute to it, and to whom payment currently goes and under what circumstances. What the condition of the account is, and I don't want to put Ms. Fitzgerald. I don't want to put you in a bad spot of having to bring us bad news. But I understand that the fund itself is fairly tight, and so we just need to hear a little bit about that and what's happening with it. So if you would give us that information, please.
Thank you, Chair Clark. I'm Jerry Fitzgerald, Program Director of the Crime Victims Programs for the Department of Justice. This is a program that has been around since 1977, but in the last several years has experienced a tremendous amount of growth, primarily as a result of some changes in the 1987 legislature where we expanded benefits to victims of family violence. And our statistics would show since then we've probably increased our caseload by 100%. We did not get an increase in staff at the same time that the program was expanded, and so today we have a huge claims volume inventory that claims pending to be worked. As Ms. Shelton indicated, we're not always able to respond to the claimants and their needs in a timely fashion or as soon as we would like to, and the benefits are limited today to the primary victim. We're receiving approximately 200 new claims today from claimants around the state, and with about 200 a month. And with the existing claims examiner staff, we're able to issue decisions on about 120 claims a month. So each month we go in the hole. We have a claims inventory today of just over 2,200 claims pending decisions. So that means we have claims in our office that came in the summer of 1989 that are still waiting for decisions to be issued.
And currently, the sources of the funding again?
The program is funded through three different sources. We have general fund allocation. We receive federal funds, which comes from a federal tax on offenders, persons convicted of federal crimes, and we receive state penalty assessment funds that comes from assessments on people convicted of state crimes. The federal amount that we get is figured on 40% of our state payout of 2 years prior.
What is the, what kind of situation is the fund going to go through down in Ways and Means this session with general fund dollars?
We're have just recently completed our proposal or our presentation to Ways and Means, and I'm not sure what the complete picture is. We have our charts and graphs down there, but would be looking at a substantial financial obligation for the claims that are in the system today, and would be asking for an increase in general fund as well as an increase in our staffing situation to address the cases that are in the system today.
How do you expect to fare?
I wouldn't want to guess on that.
Council, question for you. Do we have other bills coming to us involving the compensation fund?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at the last public hearing and work session on this bill, what the committee chose to do was move the provisions of House Bill 2406, which dealt with the compensation fund itself, and which are the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/18/91. The provisions of 2406 that got moved into this bill do two things. It increases from 6 months to a year the length and time in which a child victim of a sex offense can apply to the fund, so long as it's within the applicable statute of limitations. So part of the committee's rationale at that time was that there were two sections to 2406. The first and second section had to do with the victim compensation program. The third section had to do with transferring the responsibility of sex abuse evaluations from local government to state government. There was a $500,000 fiscal impact to that part, and the committee was concerned that due to the fiscal impact that 2406 would not perhaps make it out of Ways and Means, and the committee wanted to consider the other victim compensation issues. So on a motion of the last hearing, the remaining parts of 2406 were amended into 2492 as it now sits in front of you. I'm not aware, I shouldn't say that, to date, pending the 600 bills that were filed yesterday that I have not yet seen. My understanding is there were 600.
That are filed on Monday.
Is that all?
Well, we know how many of them were yours. I'm not aware. There are no other bills in the committee currently that deal with the issue of the Crime Victims Compensation Fund or program. And out of the pending 600, I have not yet been notified that there are. So at this point, the two that we have been merged into one bill.
Do you, Ms. Fitzgerald, do you know of any other bills affecting that are out there affecting the fund?
Yes, Chair Clark, I am aware of several bills that we have submitted that would address future claims in limiting our potential clientele, and one that would address punitive damages awards coming to our program.
Those bills have all been introduced.
Yes.
They were dropped yesterday at the request. They're part of yesterday's package? I mean Monday's package?
Yes.
All right.
And they're coming to the House.
And are they coming to House Judiciary? And are they coming to House Judiciary Family Justice?
We can request it.
Okay. Here's what I'm going to do. This bill has a referral to Ways and Means.
No, 2492 does not have a referral to Ways and Means.
Why? Maybe you just explain that to me.
Because we had not yet reached that point, nor did we have a fiscal impact on it yet, because the committee had not completed its work.
Have we asked
for a fiscal impact? Was not a fiscal impact done.
Because we moved
the fiscal impact on 2406 in terms of the effect on the crime victims compensation program was negligible. So when we dealt with the issue of expanding it to a year for child victims, that was not seen as having a significant fiscal impact. Because the committee had not completed work on the issue of secondary victims, we had not gotten one on the secondary victims part of this.
Okay, which is not to say that there won't be one.
Correct, if there's some way that fiscal can identify it.
All right. Mrs. Gerald, you know this program. Your suspicion as to the fiscal impact of this bill on the fund?
Would be substantial. We have estimated limiting it to children witnesses only would be about It was about $270,000 over the 91-93. And that would be children who were witnesses at a crime.
Do you have any sense for what the fiscal impact will be of the other bills that you had mentioned a minute ago? Some of which I realize will have a positive fiscal impact.
Right. We haven't run all of the figures on those, okay. But those would be a negative or positive fiscal impact.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Fitzgerald?
I'd like
Parks.
Tell how much do you? What's the budget now, without any additions? Just roughly. I'm just trying to get a feel for this.
Our Representative Parks, I would have to get the budget figures. I can tell you about how much we spend a month on claim payments.
Okay,
today we're averaging about $180,000 a month in claim payments.
And how many claims would that, what would be the average cost per claim?
The average cost per claim appears to be about $3,000. The statute has a maximum cap of $23,000 per victimization. That's $10,000 for medical and mental health counseling, $10,000 for time loss, and $3,000 for rehabilitation, $2,000 for funeral costs. But our average seems to be running about $3,000 per claim.
Can you generalize what percentage is for what you call treatment and what percentage is for like lost wages or that kind of?
My guess on that, Representative Parks, is the majority of it is for treatment, counseling, medical costs, and a minor portion of it would be for time loss.
And what we're proposing here in this very limited, this is really limited. You got to be a witness, you got to be a youngster, and it's only for out-of-pocket costs. And that's $270,000?
I want to. You mentioned a minute ago charts and pictures and graphs and stuff. You have that stuff available in some form or another that you could bring to us?
Yes, Chair Clark.
Would you be willing to come back, give us maybe a more comprehensive overview of the fund so that we can make a little more intelligent decision about our responsibility with this and other bills that will be coming our way? Could you be able to come back and give us
I'd be pleased to do that.
And that might make more sense, committee. I'm thinking rather than to get her guesstimate to actually come back with the program in front of us, we can make, it sounds to me like this bill is going to have to go to Ways and Means. And it seems to me that if we could send all of the bills involving the Crime Victims Fund to Ways and Means at the same time, some of which are going to have a positive impact, it sounds like, you might be able to save this proposal in Ways and Means. That's my concern. And I don't know the politics of the Ways and Means Committee very well. Representative Parks.
One question I'm going to want to answer when you come back is, if we put so many people in the program that there's not enough money to fund it according to the statute, how will you decide who gets what? That's what I'm going to want to know, and I know that's a tough question.
Representative Parks, that's a good question and certainly would be a policy question that we would have to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. When you come back, I wish you would just take at least a glancing blow at the question of really dealing with the actual victims here who are not limited to the children, but it may include the spouses, the parents where children are the victims, the brothers and sisters who may be present, those who are present, the family members. We are talking about just children, but obviously we've got other folks out there who can be just as impacted by this. And then another aspect of that I think Representative Mannix raised last time was not those who may be actually present at the instant of the crime, but who encounter it, maybe the ones who find the victim, who are as they're as traumatized by the aftermath. But the legitimate victims, we're not just talking about everybody in the apartment house, but the people who really are impacted by this. And bearing in mind that we're dealing with a finance question here, and we're supposed to be dealing with the policy question, not the money question, but if you could take a shot at that, it would be very helpful.
Okay. Yes, I certainly will, Representative Edmondson. And in the files that we look at, you're absolutely right, that family members are seriously traumatized by crime. whether they're a witness to the crime or living with the victim who's trying to survive the crime.
Representative Mannix.
I'm concerned about a broader issue, which is the backlog of claims, which from your testimony is growing. Is there a budget proposal which will allow you to address that backlog, catch up, and be current and maintain currency?
Representative Mannix, yes, we have submitted a budget proposal asking for additional staff positions to address the rising claim volume and the backlog. With 2,200 claims in the system today, it's going to take us a while to work that down, but we have requested additional staff positions.
That include funding for, say, some temporary positions to catch up and then some permanent positions to keep you current?
Representative Mannix, we did not request funds for temporary staff positions, no. It's for permanent positions.
Oh, okay. I'm not on Ways and Means. I'm just concerned about those claims that are just sitting out there.
A valid concern.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, just folks in the audience who may be kind of wondering which direction we're going. We have the unfortunate problem of having to send certain substantive bills that we enact to the Ways and Means, which is the Budget Committee, so that they can find money for what we do. And we can lobby the Ways and Means Committee. We can tell them that we strongly support a certain proposal, but ultimately we can write the proposal. They have to decide whether or not they can find the money for it. What we're talking about doing now is holding this bill for a couple of days or a short period of time till we get some other related bills in front of us that might have a positive impact on the fund, so that we can send the whole package down to Ways and Means and sort of help them find the money to do some of the things that we want to do. Otherwise, we're afraid we'll send it down there and never see it again. Representative Mannix.
As a follow-up to that, as I understand it, half of punitive damage awards go into your fund?
Representative Mannix, the way the statute reads today, it's a third. After the attorney's cut, then half of the award.
So if we change the punitive damages formula to increase your share, we'd be increasing your funding.
That's correct.
Thank you. Do we have a bill on that, Council?
Apparently it's coming.
Thank you.
This committee was kind enough to drop it as a committee bill for the Department of Justice on Monday.
Representative Edmondson.
Does the fund have a lien against civil recovery that may result because of the crime for damages?
Representative Edmondson, we have subrogation rights. If the victim is successful in a civil suit, the program would be paid back for any costs we have paid out on.
Okay. Do you bring any civil actions, or is there any attempt? I mean, in an insurance company, if a subrogation clause allows the insurance company to actually bring the action to recover costs, if the insured party doesn't want to sue, they become a party to a lawsuit for the benefit of the insurance company. Do you have such a means in your?
We do not routinely initiate.
Or can you?
I would need to check the statute to see on that. I would need to check the statute.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
The bill's not in front of us, but some of us be a lot more kindly disposed to punitive damages if.
It's coming.
Yeah, if the formula was up.
It's on its way.
As to who gets the money.
All right. Further questions? All right, Ms. Fitzgerald, we'll ask you to come.
I just have a comment, not a question. I just had a seed for thought, future thought, and as we listen to Mrs. Shelton's testimony, her daughter did not witness the crime, and yet it was in serious need of help. And I'm wondering if we start mulling around the thought of allowing a family to make some decisions where that money's going to go. Initially, take for example, if a child is the victim, the parents were not offenders, some initial counseling for the parents early could save some long-range counseling for the child later on if they were given guidance on how to handle this thing or guide their family through it, or a spouse. So maybe we ought to consider having some discretionary power, ability within a family to make some decisions. For example, just a small amount of counseling with someone other, outside the family may have given her daughter enough to go on than corroborated by her mother's counseling. But with the same amount of money, let them have some decision-making policies within the family.
Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
One other request, and that is of our witness. Since we're going to be dealing with this later, I'd be real curious as to, since these bills have the right relating clauses, whether or not we could bump into them, a temporary staffing provision to allow you to catch up. You may have other staff provisions that'll later allow you to remain current, but the bill's got the right kind of relating clause, and if it's got to go to Ways and Means anyway, if we figure out some other ways of increasing your funding, we could also do something to make sure you have some temporary staff to get, you know, you could bring in some retired claims examiners from elsewhere, train them, and put them to work for 6 months. This is the Christmas tree bill for victims' compensation.
All right, thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, we'll ask you to come back with your charts and pictures and all that sort of stuff, and I'll ask you to work with council on scheduling that along with the other bills that we talked about. Okay, thank you. We will move out of public hearing on House Bill 2492. And open the public hearing on House Bill 2193. We're going to ask
in terms of restricting the access by the Department of Justice only to those records that are actually relevant to the abuse investigation itself or to the labor arbitration proceeding. And if it's not against your protocol to suggest a further amendment, I'd just like to say that we would not be opposed to further restricting that subsection so that it's clear, and this was just brought to my attention today, so that it's clear that the release for personnel actions is limited only to records relevant to the alleged action or inaction by the staff. And as I said, Ms. Raffel is here to give you further testimony with regard to the need that the Department of Justice has from Fairview's perspective with regard to the access to these records. My final point is that this does not change, expand, alter at all access by third parties. This only gives the state's lawyers access, and third-party access is still prohibited or limited under subsection 9 of the original statute. I'm still on the mental health and developmental disabilities side, so I'm referring to ORS 179.5059. So this is really just to give lawyers access. The lawyers' then use of the records in court would be limited by the provisions of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. We'd stand in the shoes just like any other attorney as to our use in court. And our use in contested cases would be limited by the provisions of the APA. So it's not give us the records and we'll give them to the newspapers. Give us the records and we'll use them like other lawyers do in the same and similar circumstances. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Parks.
Patient was on was out on the street in Salem, got hit by a car, sued the driver. Would the defendant driver's lawyer have access to the records to show what the physical condition was prior to the accident?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, the defendant's lawyer could access those records pursuant to the current provisions of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, which we think are overridden by the restrictive prohibitions in this statute. And we're just trying to take that away so we stand on even footing with the defendant's lawyer.
If I'm the driver's lawyer, I can get access, but if the patient falls out of the bed at the hospital and sues the state, then the state's lawyers can't get access to see what his physical condition was before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, that is our reading of the statute.
Okay. Council's got a question, then Representative Mannix.
This is fun. Pamela, I just have a question about whether or not there was any discussion about use of the words, any written account in line 7,
and then the subsequent actions that you're defending. When you look at the words of the statute and what written account is, if you have particularly a long-term patient, I mean, you could have a file of an individual who's got 20 or 25 years worth of written accounts, to which this would apply, but the date of the action may be June 1, 1990. So what this would give you do is access to that client's entire record back to the day of admittance, which would be, let's say, 1960 when they were moved over from Columbia Villa. So as I see it, there's nothing that has limited it in the way that you have attempted to limit the personnel action so that it is, in fact, relevant to the action at question.
I'll let her answer.
Mr. Chair, counsel, you're correct that there's nothing in the bill itself that limits our access to the relevant portions of the record. However, there are other statutes out there which would limit our access to relevant portions of the record. If we want to use the record in court, ORCP 44 incorporates by reference ORCP 36B, which is a relevancy limitation.
But this lets you initially to just have access to the entire record, initially, without, prior to the initial investigation, the entire file is open.
Counsel, I believe that is correct. The lawyer could review the file in order to determine what, if anything, related to the action, but the authority to review does not equal authority to publicly release. And once you get to the public release stage, the rules of civil procedure in a judicial forum, the APA in an administrative forum, and our verbally proposed amendment in the arbitration forum would, in fact, limit the use to relevant portions of the record, so you wouldn't be disseminating widely and publicly irrelevant portions.
What are the sanctions or disincentives to do that, if that is done? If irrelevant portions are used, or if there is some sort of public release of those records, what happens?
Mr. Chair, in a judicial forum, the lawyer would be dealt with by the judge. I mean, it's just like any use of irrelevant evidence. And again, I can't stress enough that what we're trying to do simply is stand in the same shoes as the private litigant.
Yeah, but I mean, in one sense, you're not in the same shoes as a private litigant to the extent. Counsel, go ahead.
Well, just following that up, if a person wants to sue Salem Hospital for treatment at Salem Hospital, and you get information that person had been seen the week before at Providence, you would have to go through different steps to get the records from Providence Hospital to support or defend the action at Salem. That second step would be avoided under this bill. And so you would, in fact, be in a better situation than a private attorney would be. Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Hang on.
Mr. Chair and counsel, in the Salem Hospital situation, if the physician who was being sued had relied on the Providence records, I believe they would be incorporated into the Salem Hospital records, or they may have been, and counsel for that Salem physician could have access.
No, I'm saying there's no knowledge. He's in Emmanuel week one, he's in Salem Hospital week two. And they sue Salem Hospital. The lawyer defending Salem Hospital would not have access to the records at Emmanuel Hospital, because they would not have been known to them at the time.
Mr. Chair and counsel, you're correct that if the action was not also against a physician at Emmanuel Hospital, counsel for the physician at Salem Hospital would not necessarily have access. It's a who is the client problem when applied to the state. The state is the state is the state, and you're right that because the state is Damish OSH Fairview, that if there were relevant records pertaining to all three, this bill would indeed give the state's attorney access to those records.
Mr. Chairman.
And
Representative Maddox.
You're conceding too much. The analogy would be if you talked about Salem Hospital General Unit, which used to be out there, and Salem Hospital Memorial Unit, two units of the same entity, if you want to talk about analogies to the state, not two separate entities. Your analogy might be correct if we talked about the state of Oklahoma and the state of Oregon. But I'm not here to debate that point. I don't want any concession to be made that this bill somehow puts the state in a better position than a private attorney, because I don't think it does. I have a more technical question, and that has to do with page 2 of your amendments. And I'll ask you to focus on it for a moment.
Okay, Representative Mannix, we're going to have to move on, so I'm going to ask you to keep your questioning brief.
Page 2 of your amendments, line 12. Read that sentence, I guess. You better read up to that. The restriction contained in this section shall not apply to inspection or release of written accounts made under 179.505, 2 or 3. Then you don't say or with the consent of the inmate, because 2 or 3 don't really talk about consent releases. Don't you need the word or in there, or with the consent of the individual concerned?
Representative Mannix, I drafted this provision, and Ms. Robinson sent it over to Legislative Council. I had a comma after sub 2 to indicate that it's only released under sub 3 where the consent would be required.
So we should have a comma after 2.
That would help clarify.
Thank you. Just trying to keep
Thank
on top
you,
of this,
Mannix.
Mr.
No, Chairman. I appreciate that. All right, here's what we need to do. Ms. Rethel, is that right?
Yes.
Do you have anything to add to the testimony that's been given so far?
The only thing that I would like to add, Mr. Chair, is the fact that Fairview does support this being passed in order to ensure that we are giving due process rights to our employees. And in many cases, when we go forth on abuse cases, we do need to use the record in defending the agency's action. If it's an instance where the record has been falsified, the client's record, we may not have individuals who are willing to say, yes, I falsified the record. We may need to produce the actual record to show that there was falsification. Or if employees who could have testified as to whatever was in the record have left the employment of the agency, we may well need to produce the record or produce physical evidence, as was mentioned earlier, in support of the claim. And that, in large part, is to ensure that the employees do have their due process rights. If, in some cases, if we cannot produce copies of the records, we may not be able to take disciplinary action against an employee who has perpetrated abuse against a client. And that's our concern. But we only want to use the part of the record that actually applies to the situation. We do not want to see the entire record opened up. So we do share that concern.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. I want to ask Ella Johnson from the Mental Health Association and Leslie Kay from the Oregon Advocacy Center to come on up and give the committee a little bit of sense for what I'd like to try and get accomplished today. We have the House Bill 2407 scheduled for work session. That's the sex offender registration bill. I would very much like to move that bill today, or at least get to it. So what I'd like to do is to hear from these folks, both of whom are in opposition to the proposal in House Bill 2193. I'd like to hear from them, have the committee have a chance to ask questions, and then we will revisit House Bill 2193 on another day, because I would like to get to House Bill 2407. So with that, Ms. Johnson, Ms. Kay, thank you for coming, and please give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Clark and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Ella Johnson. I'm an attorney representing the Mental Health Association of Oregon. As Pamela Abernathy indicated, just to give you a little history on the bill, our understanding is that the original bill was just to address records problems in the corrections area. Subsequently, the bill was amended. The Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division discovered that they had a problem with personnel actions. They were sometimes unable to get the records to terminate employees who abused patients at Fairview Training Center and at the psychiatric hospitals, because they couldn't get the patient's consent to release the records. So House Bill 2193 was amended again, to address that problem. And we were brought in as an advisory basis to talk to the Mental Health Division when they were considering that amendment. And we were very shocked when it came out with a full amendment giving the Department of Justice free access to the patient's records as well as the inmate's records. While we can appreciate the Department of Justice frustration in not having ready access to these records and having to go to court to get court orders to get them, and while we support the Mental Health Division's efforts to get rid of and terminate those employees who abuse patients, we do have a few concerns about the bill that we'd like to raise. But before I do that, I'd like to just respond to Ms. Abernathy's argument that this amendment would put the Mental Health Division and or the Department of Justice on even footing with other private attorneys. And I guess we believe in America that that kind of argument doesn't wash. In this country, the actions of government are limited more than the actions of private parties, you know. So I guess if that were true, we wouldn't have a constitution. If the government was treated the same as private parties, mental health and development and the Department of Justice are the state, and I think that it's appropriate that there are some checks and balances on them in the terms of a court order or some other kind of legal proceeding that they have to jump through because of the tremendous power that they have. The first concern we have is that the bill, as currently worded, is too broad. It appears to give the Department of Justice unlimited access to the patient's records and any other records, not just that patient's records, but, you know, another patient's records, you know, George's records next door. And that's without the patient's consent. We are concerned that this unlimited and unchecked access will lead to abuse of the records. Those who are mentally ill are particularly vulnerable to attorneys using their mental illness against them. And that's recorded in throughout their clinical records. And moreover, their records routinely contain, I don't know if you've ever reviewed records of mental patients, but they contain unsupported statements and opinions and hearsay that are oftentimes untrue. I represented many clients that were under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board when I was in private practice, and I couldn't believe the records. And maybe part of the problem is that develop some kind of a procedure to train mental health professionals in how to log these records. You know, I'm just shocked at the things that we found in the records that were untrue. And these records may have they may not only be untrue, but they may have no relevance to the claim that the patient has filed or to the employee abuse. However, these untruths in these records can certainly be useful in destroying the patient's credibility, both by the state in defending against an action and by another attorney who's defending in a personnel action.
Sure. Representative Bauman.
Could you give us an example of what you're talking about?
Well, for example, I've had, Representative Bauman, I've had clients where they have been delusional and said things, and the mental health professional has recorded them. And then, you know, maybe 2 months later, they got better, and then they said something else. And then the mental health professional will say, well, this person is a liar, is a congenital liar, or, you know, because of their mental illness, they don't always track what's going on. So that's in the records to show that that person is a liar. You know, I mean, it's a credibility thing. Does that make sense? I mean, yeah, because I've seen that happen.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Representative Mannix.
Just a follow-up on that, though. I mean, isn't that really just putting the person's records in the totality of context? And if someone's delusional, can't that be explained?
Well, you know, I think it can be, but I think that, Chairman Clark was indicating, that the amendments that allow access to all the records, not just for personnel actions, don't have any limiting language, and they could into the full.
Wasn't the language chosen pretty carefully, though? We had an explanation on personnel records, but in terms of actions involving one's medical or mental condition, when I'm going over records in my private practice as an attorney, when I go over medical records, even though relevancy is in the eye of the beholder, and what I may later find I can use is one thing. What I can publish is one thing if I'm a government attorney, I suppose. But when I'm reviewing the records to understand what really matters, sometimes there are little things that come up over years. The counsel was talking about 20 or 30 years of records. I may find that there's a pattern suddenly, or there's some background information that puts things in context, and those seemingly irrelevant items all of a sudden become relevant to the issue at hand. because of a pattern that I discern. For instance, from your perspective, the delusional conduct, if you've got 30 years of delusions and that's revealed to explain away inconsistencies, then you've suddenly established that somebody's not a liar, but they have a history of delusions. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. That's a good point.
And doesn't that actually allow some balance to the review of these records? In fact, if we said the DOJ people could only see this sliver of the records, they might misperceive, in terms of reviewing and investigating, what was really going on with the individual. Now, the other side of it, though, is when they want to use the records in a proceeding, they're limited to relevant records. Do you see the balance we're talking about?
That's correct. And I think that, like you say, relevance is in the eye of the beholder. And sometimes, you know, especially untrained attorneys who don't understand mental illness may pick things out of the records that may, what they perceive, create a pattern, but are not really a pattern. I guess what I'm just saying is that, you know, people's mental health records are their whole life history. You know, they may say, you know, when they were 5 years old, they were abused by their mother or whatever, you know. And I think in fairness to the mental health patient, I think we should limit the access to the records as much as possible.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I just had one other concern that we are raising. We're concerned that under these amendments, patients who are competent to give consent to release their records will not be given the opportunity to decide whether or not they want that to happen. Contrary to popular opinion, many who suffer from mental illness are competent to make those decisions. We acknowledge that it may not be true in the area of developmental disabilities. However, those who are competent should be allowed, as a part of a right as a human being, to make determinations on their own records. And once that person decides whether or not those records should be released, for example, in a personnel action, you know, I don't think that the state should circumvent that by taking that ability away and using those records.
Chair? Okay, not a question, but a comment.
Okay.
I just would urge, I don't think we're getting into work session on this bill today from earlier signals. Perhaps you folks can meet with Ms. Abernathy and her colleagues to see if there's some common ground on some of those issues.
Yeah,
We'd be happy to do that.
I'd like to hear from Ms. Kay, and then that's going to be very much the request that I make of all the parties. So, Ms. Kay, if you can take a few minutes and add to what Ms. Johnson has given us, and we'll have questions.
I'll try and not repeat anything either and keep my comments limited. For the record, I'm Leslie Kay from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and you have Robert Jundeff's testimony before you, I hope, and I'm standing in for him today. He had a trial and wasn't able to appear before the committee. You know, our major concern is about the scope of the disclosure of information. I think the language, we have some objections to the language here, and I would like to see if we can come to some common understanding with the Department of Justice on this. We have met preliminarily with them, and I think we all maybe have a better understanding of some of the potential pitfalls. One of the concerns we have is that this language doesn't limit release of information to the litigants or to the parties filing tort claim notices. It appears to me that the Department of Justice would have access to any record of any patient who may be peripherally involved with some sort of incident giving rise to a claim or a lawsuit. I feel uncomfortable with making comparisons between the private and public hospital world. Most of our clients, most of the patients in those facilities are there involuntarily, they're there because they're criminally insane or because they have severe, profound psychiatric disabilities or profound disabilities in general. And it's important when people have those type of disabilities that if they are to benefit from treatment, that there be the confidence that information that is contained in their records is going to be confidential. Our patients and clients in those facilities object to the very disclosure of that information unnecessarily to anyone, and the government is who they most, I think,
most strongly object to having access to that information. Of course, if they are initiating a claim, I think it's going to be in their interest to provide the Department of Justice with the information that supports that claim at the tort claim notice stage of the proceeding. I think what we're really debating about is the stage in which this information becomes available to the Department of Justice. I don't think there's been an argument here that that information never gets to the Department of Justice. I think, again, the issue that we're trying to weigh here is the confidentiality rights of the patients against the need of the Department of Justice to get this information at a stage in the litigation or in the claim process so they can make the system work more efficiently for them. But what's compromised, perhaps, is the extent of the information that is unnecessarily disclosed to the attorneys.
All right, thank you. At this point, I'm going to suggest that we close the public hearing on House Bill 2193. We thank you for being here. We were going to ask you to come back because we're not obviously done with this issue. We're going to strongly suggest that the two of you try to work with Ms. Abernathy to come up with some language, recognizing you may never be in a position where you can support the bill, mm-hmm. but in a position where, from your perspective, it's a better bill than it was before. It's more limited in certain particulars. Some of the policy decisions the committee will make one way or the other, but if you could bring us language that you're more comfortable with, I suspect that the department would be more than willing to work with you on that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I apologize to the gentleman from the Corrections Department and General Services. We will have your testimony when we revisit this bill. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2193. Move into work session on House Bill 2407, which is our registration of sex offenders bill. Counsel, can you bring us up to speed on when we last left this drama?
Mr. Chair, members of the
what
committee.
What were Mary and John saying to each other?
You will find a packet on 2407. Let me just walk you through it. The first page is an updated staff measure summary, which is irrelevant today. Page 2, entitled Section 7, is a amendment that I think Representative Bell will be discussing, and so I will leave that to her. Pages 3 and 4 are the committee amendments that were adopted at the last work session. Just briefly, and I hope the committee will indulge counsel in that these usually get written late at night and they tend to get a little quirky, but the committee at its last hearing added a Section 1 that would establish the purposes of the Act to aid law enforcement, added compelling prostitution and promoting prostitution, added an additional part to the relief section, which was adopted, that states that a person may apply to the circuit court for relief no sooner than 10 years after the date of conviction. Added a fourth provision that if the court so determines that the juvenile department would be the party responsible for entering the law enforcement data, so entering into the LED system the relevant information, clarifying that it was description of the methodology of the state, added a responsibility to provide annually or within 30 days of a change of residence the person's address in writing to the state police. There are two changes there. One is the annual requirement, and the other one is to the state police. That's 7 and 8. I mean, that's 6 and 7. 8 is a modification to the bill that the current failure provisions are Class C felonies or Class A misdemeanors, and that a failure to file an annual report is a violation. For those of you that read the last sentence and also guess who proposed the most of these, I will also buy you a Tootsie Roll Pop. The next page is information that I asked Mr. Foss from the parole board to obtain regarding numbers of victims that they thought would want to be notified, to give some sense from the state police or whoever was going to be handling this, the kind of numbers. I think what's important on this information is that, first of all, it replies to October, November, December of this past year. Out of 1,000 hearings conducted by the board, 12%, which is, what's 12% of 1,000?
120.
120 letters went out, And out of the 120, there were 60 witnesses who appeared. So if I do this correctly, my numbers are correct. Out of 1,000 hearings, approximately, there were 60 victims who attended. It was indicated to me that the numbers of victims who are requesting notification is increasing, and the committee will note that the first figure there is that they added in that same period of time 199 victims just to the tracking system. So I think that these numbers will continue to build. I would also note that these are not broken down by offense. I think there was some testimony that 20% of all sex offenders, of all felony offenses, are sex offenses. I seem to recall that figure. But whether or not that matches with this group, there's no way of knowing at this point. But I thought it would be important to have numbers.
Thank you. When we left then, what we were waiting for, I think, was the proposal for some victim notification. As I take it, Council, your memo to Virginia Vanderbilt asks her to draft the amendments that the committee adopted in conceptual form on Monday. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Okay. I mean, it seems to me, okay, I'm recalling
so
that.
So we don't need to revisit those issues, I don't think.
I don't believe so.
I think we fought those battles and we're over that turf. So all that remains really is to decide whether and what we would like to do in terms of victim notification. Let me poll the committee here publicly for a minute. My understanding was, let's set aside the question of victim notification for a minute. My understanding was that when we left this issue on Monday, the committee was ready to go with the bill, and then the idea came up. So I'm still hoping to move the bill today with or without the victim notification section in it. So adding pressure to Representative Bell's presentation, tell us about Section 7.
I think we've made it very easy for you. I met with Major Renfro, and we talked about two approaches, the optimum and the realistic, and what you have before you is the realistic, which I think is still going a major step forward. This particular amendment is based...
Sections don't match.
Excuse me for a minute.
Sorry. Sections are all misnumbered.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. This particular approach puts the responsibility to find out the information on the victim themselves, rather than having the state track the victim's address and report to them on a regular basis. This establishes a toll-free number where the victim can call at any time to find out the county of residence of the offender. And I'm going to emphasize that word county because they're what we did discuss later, the importance of not giving out addresses because of the case of retribution,
right,
or that sort of thing, but county seemed to be the direction we would go. The victim would receive an ID number, which would get them access to the line, so that not just every person in the world could call and get information, and they would be informed that any misuse of that ID number would cause them to lose the